Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical
sort of
podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we'll answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends.
On today's show, we're going to continue to focus on innovation and technology in healthcare. We're going to talk to Venkatesh Ramnath, a pulmonary critical care doctor who is a pioneer in telemedicine for critical care patients.
Please make sure to like us on Facebook, review us on iTunes, and tell your friends to listen.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
How we doing, guys?
We're doing pretty good.
Pretty good.
I saw something on TV that was very interesting. I want to discuss with Lizzie in particular, but I would love to hear Joe's input on this as well. Something I'd never seen before. There was a commercial for a woman's hygiene product.
Douche.
No. It was like a tampon. No, it was like a pad. What are they called? Tampon?
Maxi pad?
Maxi pad. Sorry.
Tampons.
Not the tampons, because tampons are the insertable, like, suppository type thing. This is the, like, the kind of thing that, like, diaper. What's it called? Maxi pad, right?
Toilet paper?
No.
No. You're both wrong. I don't know. Just keep going.
It's a maxi pad.
Maxi pad. I saw a commercial for a woman's hygiene product, a maxi pad. And there was one subtle difference that I had never seen before. This was a British commercial that they were showing. And can you guess what it was? Can you guess? Don't look this up.
I'm not.
Lizzie's going to a computer. Can you guess what the difference was? It was a subtle little thing.
I'm going to guess.
Guess.
A scent.
A scent? No. No.
Like a beautiful scent.
Honestly, that's a good invention, actually.
Now, think about whenever you see, like, whenever you see these.
No, Joe. How often are you smelling a woman's used
I never
maxi
do.
Pad?
I stay away.
No.
I'm just
this
saying.
Is getting weird
I know,
real
sorry.
Quick. Anyways. So normally when you see these commercials for these sanitary napkins, they usually show the liquid that goes into them in blue, like a little blue dye. And they're like, look how it absorbs the blue dye. It's the best blue dye. And then in the background, there's like a woman running through a field and she's being like really active, like maybe at the beach in a bikini or like playing tennis or something. But they always show the liquid as a blue dye. This one showed it as a red dye. Now that sounds real subtle. That sounds real subtle, but it's a very big difference because in general, since like the dawn of time, since the red tent, when women were forced to go out into a tent when they were menstruating, people are terrified of women's menstruation. This is like such
because it's a source of power.
I don't trust anything that bleeds for 5 days and doesn't die.
Who said that?
I forget where.
That's a great line.
But anyways, men have been terrified of this, or they don't like talking about it. It's super weird for people, but it's like a natural part of like life. It's a natural part of people's bodies. And I think it was sort of an amazing thing to see that. To see
is
that
this something you noticed, or they were pointing out?
They were pointing it out.
Oh, because that is interesting. Now, because I think that the red tent exists and it's has this, you know, stigma for men in particular because it's seen as dirty and unhygienic. So red, really, I mean, you don't necessarily want to see like blood or a version of blood on TV. You know, you're trying to make it look at how a sanitary napkin is going to make you feel clean and look clean and keep things neat because, you know, your period can be messy.
Yeah.
And then when you show this red dye, that is sort of interesting and like an interesting like sort of marketing technique. And I do wonder how many like sort of test groups they had to go through to get to the on air, you know?
Yeah. I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing because there's still it's a like I said, it's a normal part of for many people a healthy like life to have menstrual cycles. And we have to understand that that happens and that it's a real thing that occurs and that's okay.
Kind of like women shitting. right? Guys do
they
not
don't.
Want to know about it
they
for some
don't.
Stupid
just
reason.
Just so you know, women don't want to know about men shitting either.
It's for some reason, it's more accepted. I don't know why.
No.
Am I wrong? No?
Well,
guys fart, okay. A woman farts, she's like ostracized. She's not being ladylike or some stupid thing.
It's a good point. It's
burping. Not,
I am sort of under the assumption that women poop out little pink hearts. That
yeah, me too.
It,
roses.
I could be wrong about that.
That's
we don't
want
to know.
But yeah.
Joe, you have a question.
Yes, I do have a question. It's related to medications and different reactions with different people. And you can use it pretty much in any field of medicine. It seems like one medication for one person could be a total disaster for another, even if they have the same prognosis. Sure. Do you know why that is? I always hear, well, it's just everyone's different. But what is beyond, deeper than that? What's the explanation, or do you know?
I mean, it's a hard question. I don't think there's one answer. You know, for Kaveh and I, we prescribe like acid blockers all the time, like Prilosec, which is omeprazole, and Nexium, which is esomeprazole. You know, all these medicines are like the same class, and Motrin and ibuprofen and Excedrin and not Excedrin, but an Advil. And why one person swears by one and not another? You know, there's tiny nuances difference between these chemical structures of the medication. So maybe that's it. But also people are made differently, you know, so my genes are different from your genes. So I might respond differently to a medication. And something that I mentioned earlier is that I do think that sometimes when medications are identical, Advil or Motrin, for instance, are very similar. I do think that there's like a placebo and a marketing effect that has an influence.
Extra strength.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why is extra strength 1,000 milligrams of Tylenol better than 2 pills that are 500 milligrams?
Right,
like,
right.
They're the same thing. But I do think that there is that placebo effect. And again, marketing, I think that's sort of all told together. And, you know, why a doctor would choose one over another, you know, there might be something that sort of, you know, two blood pressure medicines aren't identical, but one might help with like your prostate and your blood pressure, and one might help with your blood pressure. You know, that's not answering your question exactly, but I do think the best doctors try to tackle, hopefully, two different problems with one medication if that's an option.
And literally everyone is different. I don't mean their personalities. I mean the way that they break down medication. Everyone has a slightly different way that they break down medications. The enzymes that you have in your body are not the same as the enzymes I have in my body. So if we take a pill, the way your body breaks it down and turns into something that's useful, or the way the byproducts are made from that are a little different, maybe tiny, minuscule difference, but there's little differences in the way those things happen. So everyone is a little bit different.
Yeah.
And in addition to people being different, and, you know, metabolism and genetic kind of interactions is also what you do to your body. So if you, you know, take another medicine, maybe that will have an interaction with this second medicine. And maybe Kaveh is not taking that other medicine. So medicine interactions is a huge thing. And also like alcohol and diet and exercise.
Yeah, a lot of factors.
Yeah, there are. Like, it's a great question. And I don't think that there's, you know, if there's a specific medication question you want to ask, we can like look into that. But globally, it's really sort of hard to tease out. Anyway,
good answer. It's
a good question, Joe.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You like how she sounded a little surprised? She's like,
not bad for a producer guy.
Now stick around. We have a great guest coming up. We'll be right back.
I'll introduce Dr. Venkatesh Ramnath, based in UC San Diego, right? With a focus and publications on tele-ICU systems, bioethical issues in the ICU. Thank you very much for being here with us. How do you distinguish what you do with the tele-ICU medicine systems versus just a one-on-one sort of Skype phone call, FaceTime phone call, patient care telemedicine, which is what we now are familiar with after interviewing Ian Tong a few weeks ago?
Oh, Ian Tong. Yeah, I know him from Doc on Demand.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's in essence, it's actually not very different at all. Well, I should say this. The difference is only the context in which the patient is being taken care of, in the sense that he was probably speaking more to an outpatient setting. So Doc on Demand or Teledoc or one of the, you know, a myriad of you know, outpatient consumer facing telemedicine platforms are primarily dealing with your average primary care needs, right? And so, but you can take the same concept and put it into an inpatient or when patients hospitalized, sorry, admitted to the hospital, you can make the same sort of use case. So in the sense that you have someone who's very ill, who had to be admitted to the hospital, or even extremely ill when they're in the ICU, you still need to have access to a doctor who's going to interface with your, well, what's going on with you, how you're feeling, your symptoms, but then also look at the data that's behind some of the, you know, laboratory physiology or your x-rays or any of those things and kind of put together an opinion based on that. So again, it's going back to the same concept. You're a doctor, you still got to see your patient, you got to evaluate the situation, provide a diagnosis if you can, and then actually provide a treatment plan. And it's the same in the outpatient, but I focus on the inpatient.
Transition into inpatient care. So an outpatient, I have a cough, I have a rash, I call a doctor and we do, again, a video visit. When you're an inpatient or an intubated patient, it's not like anyone can call you. So I guess you need like some sort of agreement with a hospital or the attendings, you know, the hospital-based physicians to start this process. Like, how does that start?
Right. No, it's a good point. So, well, what I would say is that, again, the essence is the same. So imagine that cough is not just, you know, a viral infection or a cold or something. Let's just say it's a horrible pneumonia, right? And you're admitted to the hospital and you've got doctors who are familiar with pneumonia, but not this severe. And so they don't know exactly what to do. Or say, use your example, the patient's intubated, meaning that they have a breathing tube in their throat and they're on the breathing machine. It's that serious. And so a lot of hospitals maybe don't have access to specialists who are trained in that particular expertise, you know, dealing with a ventilator, adjusting it to the right settings so that you can get the maximum benefit with minimizing the risk. And so those hospitals and those doctors actually call us or call out to places where they do have specialists that can do that. And then through a telemedicine portal, meaning that, you know, you're doing it on, in some places it's as simple as FaceTime or Skype, like we're talking about right now, like talking through right now. But sometimes it's more sophisticated. You have dedicated cameras and you have a whole group of people that are looking at a number of different hospitals at the same time. Regardless of the platform, you have expertise that is accessible often in seconds or minutes. Whereas, you know, the alternative is either you don't have someone that you can ask, or they have to come in and drive in from somewhere far away, which ultimately may, you know, be not, the timing may not work right for that. So that's kind of the scenario that we're involved in. But the essence of the encounter is the same.
So how hard was it to convince people in the first place? Because it sounds like you're pretty much on the vanguard of this and people hadn't been doing it before you. Was it hard to convince doctors, patients, administration to get you involved?
Yeah, it is an interesting point, you know, to consider in the sense that, you know, what was the first experience with Uber like, right? Or Lyft or any of those things? You have to convince people that actually not only is it doable, but it's safe. And in healthcare, we are extremely conservative, right? We really can't take that risk that someone's going to potentially be hurt by this. So, you know, that's an ongoing challenge. And I think if you look at all the telemedicine platforms, the crux of success hinges upon relationship building. You have to have that trust with whether it's a patient, if you're a consumer facing, you know, one of these Teladoc or one of these other systems, or you're in the hospital like what we do, you know, using the technology is really the minimum of the problem, right? It's about how do you get people to feel comfortable with your expertise, but through something that's a little bit less conventional. So, but it is an ongoing challenge. And if you look at the literature, it actually shows that the better you do that, the better as part of your implementation, even pre-implementation, the better the whole thing goes. And actually the more they use it, because ultimately it's only as good as what's being used, right? So
it sounds like a great way to get a second opinion very rapidly, efficiently, effectively, and hopefully cost effective as well.
Absolutely. And in fact, we don't just do this domestically or in the region. We're kind of concentrating in the region right now in UC San Diego Health. But really, the interest and the need is global. And in fact, we have a consultation service, just to speak to that second opinion point you just made, in places like the Middle East. So we have a consultation service with Saudi Arabia, a hospital there, and a very advanced hospital with a lot of different technology. But, you know, the patients and even the physicians there, the staff, really would like to have some reassurance and maybe a second opinion from a U.S. Institution of repute, right? And so we have provided that support. And honestly, it's mostly reassuring them that, yes, everything has been done, because we do analyze everything. We provide that second opinion. But it's also to reassure patients that, you know what, this is a critical illness. It's a different type of illness from other types that they may be familiar with. But I think it's also about that trust building across, that really just goes across nations, across people of different cultures and geographic and language barriers. And that's really what telemedicine is, right? It's providing medicine across different barriers, whatever they are, and wherever they are and however they appear.
So do you see this as more of a medicine that's going to help us get across issues like space and personnel? Or do you see this as the future regardless? I mean, if you're able to do this as well as you can, do we even need ICU docs in the ICU? Like, and if so, how do we need them as much? I mean, what does this say about the future of ICU care?
Right. Well, this speaks to kind of how do we envision, is this kind of a bigger idea of how do we even look at ICU medicine from the 30,000 foot view, right? And I think that that's a much more complex question. In a sense, we haven't optimized digitization. So we have a lot of different ways of getting data through sensors, through monitors, through, you know, whether they're wearable or not. We haven't optimized that. At the same time, telemedicine is a key component of that isn't wedded to being in person either, right? So if we're looking to re-engineer the entire ICU experience, we can talk, you know, at length about how that might look. But I would agree that telemedicine would be probably a strong piece of that, because it's not, you're not, again, wedded to having someone in person, which is, number one, it's not easy to do that. Number two, it's extremely expensive to do that. And ultimately, to your point, is it really necessary when you've got maybe some other mechanism to analyze a lot of data? And so without really, putting a final answer on that, I'd say telemedicine is probably a part of that. But the answer is probably a lot broader than that.
And before I get angry emails from all our pulmonology ICU friends, I only ask because maybe it'll save them a trip into the hospital at some point.
Well, there's that. And also the concept of transferring a patient. You know, we do that. That's honestly, I just saw a movie, The Big Sick. Like, you know, they talk about people transferring from hospital to hospital to get better care or care that cannot be provided. And the concept of a transfer, again, if you can imagine all the resources it uses, and the risks involved of getting the ambulance, getting the people to transport, maybe having all these bags of medications dangling, and you transfer a patient. And Joe, I don't know if you know, but like things get ripped out. You know, you turn a patient, you move a patient, IVs move, the tracheal tube moves. Like,
yeah.
This
always
is a
danger
huge
in transportation.
Risk and cost. So,
well, I think, and that speaks to, I'm sorry, Joe, did you? No, I think you, Lizzie, you just spoke to something that is a downside for basically every party. But number one, patients don't like it. They have to go somewhere that's far away from their home. Second thing is that the hospitals and the providers locally feel, you know, like they can't take care of something that goes against their sort of, you know, their feeling of providing the care that within their capability. So that's there. Also, the hospital loses money, because if you send everybody out, you're not able to take care. And then, you know, if you just look at it from a financial standpoint, you know, you can't collect on that money. And then on the other side, it totally bottlenecks a lot of other hospitals. So UC San Diego Health can't handle the volume for a lot of patients that, quite frankly, could be taken care of out elsewhere. And again, not to be, I hate to bring up finances, but, you know, it's not a cost-effective way of dealing with the problem across the board.
You should bring it up. That's essential.
Say it again.
It's essential to bring up finances. I mean, that's what drives most things in medicine, unfortunately. You know, it's a huge problem.
It is. But, you know, finances is that, you know, it's kind of that sticky point where it's been politicized and not to get into that, but you know, we don't, no one, grandma never wants to have a price tag, you know, associated with her. Right.
Right.
And yet it's a reality that we all four of us and, you know, in this room and everybody else has to face, you know, with deductibles and everything else. So, and then there's that risk, like you talked about, Lizzie, is that, you know, it's not an easy connection. If you're looking at 100 miles, you know, whether it's an air flight, which costs a lot of money, or, you know, even ground transport, it takes time. You need to have the right equipment and things happen, like you said. Even going to a CAT scanner, you know, going downstairs for an imaging can sometimes be risky, let alone driving across the state, you know, or airlifted somewhere else. So there are a lot of downsides to transferring. And telemedicine, even in the ICU, has been shown, perhaps not definitively, but there are a lot of indicators that it reduces the number of transfers. So hospitals can take care of these patients locally. Patients feel better about staying local. And then these other hospitals don't have to deal with people who, quite frankly, you know, they have their own needs that they have to support their own local population. And they can triage those patients appropriately, meaning, you know, the sickest of the sick who really need something very specialized at UC San Diego Health, they can bring those people in. And then once they're ready to go, they can actually be sent back. Whereas before, everybody would come and then they would stay and the whole place was too busy for anyone's benefit. So a lot of upsides to using telemedicine as effectively as it has shown.
Yeah, it's great stuff. And that actually kind of answered the question I was going to answer or ask you, which was, you know, how is it also clinically better, not just better for convenience and for all those other things, but it sounds like there's a lot of clinical benefits to the patient just because of all those things you mentioned, not having to transfer a patient, not having to move anybody. Another thing I was going to ask is, do you think it also could give, and I don't want to get political at all, but just more access to patients, not just in the U.S., but just to the whole world? Does it give, could it possibly result in better healthcare and more access at a much, much lower cost for everybody in the future?
Oh, I think absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the sky is kind of the limit right now. And if you look across the board, and I've had some international experience, you know, working in Africa and Indonesia and India and critical care. And I mean, the need is global. There are, you know, there are issues with bandwidth. So, you know, if you're looking at Africa, you know, I don't know if you saw, The Economist talked about Africa last week, I think, about how there's a huge bandwidth problem. So, you know, telecom is important. So as long as you have, but then you get, then again, you have Asia, which probably has better internet speeds than we do, right? And so how do you leverage the expertise that we have from a clinical standpoint here and send it across the world? There are some institutions like Emory that are actually enhancing not just the care for the patients here, but they're through tele-ICU, which is the telemedicine used in the ICU setting, but they're also enhancing the experience from the provider side, meaning that the physicians feel better using this telemedicine. And how do they do that? Let me just give an example. They actually have set up a remote site in Australia, which apparently is the exact opposite part of the world, okay, to Atlanta. And they have a team of physicians and nurses who treats people in Atlanta from there. And the reason they do that is their daytime is our nighttime. Right. So if you have nighttime in Australia, it's exactly the opposite of what's happening in Atlanta. So, and it sounds like those providers have had a great time. I mean, they can do a daytime work experience and they're covering the nights. And so the providers in Atlanta feel better. They have less on their shoulders. And yet, you know, these professionals out in Australia are able to work in a U.S. environment. So everybody kind of wins. Nowadays, you know, the internet and telecommunications are global. And so why not push it to its natural maximum? I think that's where we're in the middle of that. We haven't figured it all out, but I think we're on our way.
Yeah. Do you think that these providers who are doing it from across the world are feeling like, and you said that they have a great time and they have good satisfaction and, you know, quality of life or providing, but do you think that sometimes they feel like a little isolated from the actual touching of a patient? And we've talked about this before about the concept of a physical exam and how, you know, important that is. And how do you sort of integrate that or use a surrogate if you were like, well, someone really needs to go listen to their lungs, you know?
Right. Well, I totally agree with you. It's kind of a debate that's raging in medicine in general, whether you're in person or telemedicine. But, you know, I trained at the Mayo Clinic where, you know, they are very hands on. It was all about physical exam. I trained in at a time when that was actually still an important piece of, you know, of data. Not that it isn't now, but I think it's being questioned. As far as telemedicine, you know, one of the things we're doing at UC San Diego Health, and this is goes back to where my experience has been, is that you're absolutely right that we need to have both in synchrony, actually, in parallel. So what we're trying to encourage is telemedicine together with in-person evaluations and treatment plans. And what we would call is called a hybrid kind of solution. It's not, you know, one or the other, it's both. And it speaks to your point of you really need to have that human connection. And honestly, it may not be so much about the diagnostics in the sense of, you know, you're going to pick up that murmur in the heart, you know, area, that rumbling of the blood going on there. But it's more about how do we maintain the empathic human connection that really putting your hand on a patient can never be supplanted by, you know? And I think that's the important part of that. And yes, there are other pieces to that, but if you had to, you know, boil it down to a kernel, I think that's what we want to preserve. And so again, we're doing both. We have a hybrid, we've got telemedicine, so the technology piece, but we also got simultaneously, you've got people treating people in person.
Would your way telemedicine offer a solution to have more visibility to all the patients? Because right now you don't have a nurse in every single room necessarily. Is there an advantage just because you can see every single room simultaneously?
I think now there's just like a patient with a little button, like a little call bell. It is sort of archaic if you think about it. It's a very interesting sort of good question.
Yeah. What do you think?
That speaks to this whole redesign concept. I mean, ICU beds and the whole ICU infrastructure hasn't changed in, I don't know, 60 years, 70 years. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing, to be honest with you. And you're right that there isn't any obvious, I mean, there is a centralization to it, meaning that you have monitors that do come to a centralized place. And there is a nurse actually who is in charge of that. In fact, it happens not just in the ICU, but it happens outside the ICU in what are called telemetry beds. So when you need a heart monitor that's showing your rhythm of the heart, you know, at any moment, at any second, there are a lot of beds that are wired to provide that information. But to your point, yeah, the scalability is important, and you do need to have a way of looking at everyone so you're not reacting so much as proactively acting, right? We're not there yet. It's just the infrastructure, the financial pressures are, and I would say, you know, the healthcare is a laggard industry. I mean, it takes an average of 12 years for some new innovation to actually catch hold, whereas other industries it's much quicker, right? And so given the conservative nature of it and the fact that the technology, to your point, Joe, hasn't matured to the point where, you know, I mean, look at things like, I keep saying like Uber and Lyft, and I mean, those things didn't catch on until cell phones and smartphones got to a critical threshold, right? And a lot of people might argue, as Thomas Friedman did, I don't know if you read that book, Thank You for Being Late, but 2007 was like a pivotal moment where you've got Airbnb, you've got Uber, you've got the iPhone, all that stuff comes out at once, right? So that was a total tipping point. And I think that changed a lot of different industries almost overnight. Healthcare hasn't gotten to that point. We're close, we're getting very close. But, you know, digital health hasn't really provided that kind of bang for the buck. We've got, $900 billion of waste in our healthcare system. We're the most expensive, you know, system on the planet, really, and especially for our healthcare outcomes. And we haven't found a way to make it cost effective. We're kind of skimming it on the surface. And telemedicine is still kind of living up here, right? But once that point where, to your point, Joe, when we get these data analytics tools where we can actually get them effectively and at a reasonable price point, it will flip this overnight. And you'll see a lot of change very fast. We're trying to be smart about how do we navigate this and how do we look at this strategically, so maybe in 4 or 5 years, when then other things start shifting, that we can act quickly. And in the meanwhile, though, we're gonna focus on the people. We're gonna focus on the people that it matters for. We're gonna focus on the patients, and we're gonna focus on the people, like the providers and the nurses and the administrators that make all this happen on both sides, on our side of UC San Diego, and then also at these smaller hospitals. And that is whenever that sweet spot arrives, then we'll be ready to act.
Wow. Well, that seems like a excellent place to leave it at. That was awesome, man. Thank you so much. That's really interesting stuff. It really is, I think, the future. Where can people learn more about it, learn more about you and your group? And what, if anything, do you want to leave us with in terms of plugging?
Well, you're welcome to look us up on UC San Diego Health. In fact, we have... we have some video materials I can share with you to just give an idea, and we can distribute that as you feel comfortable. But they can find my profile on the website. I'm on the UC San Diego faculty, and I guess what I would leave people with is to be open and engaged and excited that you can get great care no matter where you are. And it can be reasonable. It can be reasonable in price. It can be reasonable, and you'll be very happy with the quality. Whomever you choose, but certainly UC San Diego Health, we've got some good docs behind us. So
great. Thank you so much for being here, Venkatesh.
Okay. All right. Take care, guys. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. Please keep up with the emails and phone calls. Keep them coming.
At hopquestions@gmail.com. And our phone number is 408-444-6623.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.